The last speaker is Dr. Hisham Helia, who will be speaking on the issue of violence within Islam, whether it is something which people do because it's demanded from us in our religion, or whether it is a deviation of the spiritual peaceful aspects of what Islam actually says. Just a quick background on Dr. Hisham. He's, as well as being associate fellow at Warwick University, he's completed a research project on the European other, basically focusing on Muslims within Europe. He's a social policy analyst and a research consultant, and he's currently researching contemporary Muslim communities within the EU. I'd like to invite Dr. Hisham.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. إن الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى آله وأصحابه أجمعين. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. First, I'd like to say I'm very pleased to be here, and I apologize to everyone who may have heard this before and who's remaining here out of adab for the speakers. They have a lot of patience, mashallah. I hope you won't mind if I stay standing and excuse me for my voice. I've got a bit of a cold. I'm not wearing this out of a fashion accessory. I'm actually cold in here, although I think it's quite nice, quite frankly. Can you all hear me, by the way? Is it okay? Yeah? Bismillah. I'm sure you'll tell me if you can. I find it particularly meaningful that IMAD hosts this event. IMAD has shown itself not to be just of popular use to the Muslim community, but of use to the community in very difficult areas. I understand recently there was an event on domestic violence, an issue which faces the Muslim community like any other community, but because of its incontrovertibly un-Islamic nature, it's an issue that Muslims are flabbergasted by and sometimes don't wish to engage with. The ethos of IMAD, to remain rooted in Islam and to bear witness to its ideals, to all through example and through action, is a deeply embedded value in the practice of the righteous forebearers of this tradition, a value that is not in spite of Islam, but because of it. I also want to say that I think this book was very timely and brought to fruition with excellent effort on behalf of Aftab Malik. Aftab Malik also does a lot of traveling. I know he was talking about Dr. Tahir coming here today, although he travels. Aftab, subhanAllah, was in Qatar last week, and I'm sure he'll be away in about 2 hours on a flight somewhere. And it was exceedingly difficult for him to complete this text in such a short time, but he accomplished the feat very well, and we are all indebted to him for so doing. He's obviously started a bit of a trend. 2 weeks ago, the issue of The New Statesman, which is a well-established leftist magazine, also had a section entitled The State We Are In. When The Spectator and The Daily Telegraph follow suit, we will know that Aftab's distribution efforts are bearing fruit in a rather extraordinary way. I want to say a few words about two main issues. My own contribution to the volume being launched today is essentially a review and a commentary on Sheikh Muhammad Afifi Al-Akiti's Rad, or refutative clarification. In other words, I didn't write it. I wrote the review and the commentary. Amongst other issues, I picked up on two major themes. The first was the rules of engagement in military conflicts as defined by the Sharia, and the second was on how the Sharia has positive demands upon the Muslim in our own context. I'm sure that in the Q&A we'll probably pick up on a number of other points as well. I hasten to add from the outset that it would have been far more beneficial for you to read this document directly with Sheikh Muhammad Afifi. He is a rare and contemporary Mufti, but unfortunately this wasn't possible today. I'm here simply as an academic trying to discuss the issues raised in that very worthwhile document with a wider audience. I have to say this very clearly. It's a legal document. It's not a political one. And it should be listened to in that vein. There are three legal particulars, fusul, that are addressed by this document with regards to military conflicts. Number one, the target of the attack, the maqtul. Number two, the authority responsible for ordering the attack. And number three, the nature of the attack. Sheikh Afifi reports not his view, but rather the view of the Shafi'i school of law on these three issues, mentioning where there is a difference of opinion when it exists, making it a rather useful and comprehensive document, not only for Shafi'is. Now on the first issue, the target. It's very clear. The target may only be direct combatants. Direct combatants include men who have walked onto the battlefield as combatants, even if they are not actively engaged in combat. This may include off-duty men, but only those who are in military bases. In this case, to target them is halal, but it is makruh, i.e. it is reprehensible, according to the qawl as-sah, the stronger opinion in the Shafi'i school. Only those who are military bases. And military bases exclude those places from which an attack would normally not originate from, where intermingling between combatants and non-combatants would take place with certainty, and where non-combatants have not been given the choice to leave. Thus, this excludes restaurants and pizzerias and so on. The next issue, the women and the children may only be targeted in direct self-defense. Off-duty women soldiers and off-duty child soldiers, and the child in the Sharia is someone below the age of puberty. Off-duty soldiers of this nature may not be targeted. Apart from these mentioned categories, all others are non-combatants and they cannot be targeted. Now in the Shafi'i school, as well as one of the other schools, there are discussions of collateral damage. And there are differences of opinion in this regard as to what constitutes collateral damage, if it is to be entertained at all. And many of the ulama said that collateral damage was categorically forbidden, could not be entertained. However, some did allow it, subject to the stipulations that I mentioned, and then they add more stipulations for collateral damage. But many of the ulama commented on the fact that the Prophet ﷺ generally fought during the daytime, precisely because collateral damage is far more likely when you cannot see the target clearly, for obvious reasons. The second issue that the document goes into, on the authority responsible for ordering the attack. Only a legitimate state authority may order the targeting. There is no vigilantism in Islam. This is a prime prerequisite of all warfare and the Sharia. And three, the nature of the attack. The question of the method of what some call suicide bombing, others call martyrdom bombings, and I don't like either one of these titles, quite frankly. But this particular method is treated as an academic, theoretical possibility and is a question of ikhtilaf in the madhab, in the Shafi'i madhab, in the Shafi'i school of law. I.e. a difference of opinion exists. And I'll go into these two opinions, because this needs to be understood very, very clearly. The stronger opinion in the school, the stronger position, the qawl as-sah, is that the suicide bomber, or the martyrdom bomber, is actually somebody who commits suicide. And this is an action that is severely prohibited. This is the stronger opinion in the school. The second position in the school is that it is permitted, but the jurists that allow that position place even more rules of engagement than the ones I've mentioned. It is difficult to see how these rules and the aforementioned restrictions have been fulfilled in modern day examples. Now, it's important to realize that these three legal particulars are raised not out of some arbitrary choice by Sheikh Afifi, but rather due to the fact that it is a clarification of a statement that raised these three legal particulars. I'm sure, for example, that he has his views on Guantanamo Bay or Israeli targeted assassinations or American foreign policy and so on, but he is a mufti, and the mufti answers only the questions and queries that are asked of him. The mufti is not a politician. The mufti is not a partisan or biased in some way. I mean, this is an overall statement about all muftis. I'm not talking about Sheikh Afifi. The mufti is a judge of law and judges on legal issues. As I mentioned, this is a legal document, not a political one. An example of a political document might include a comprehensive advice to all of humanity on a variety of related issues, including the many deep injustices of Israeli or American foreign policy. A legal document, on the other hand, is committed to clarifying only those issues which have been asked about. This may be frustrating, and this is very understandable, but the answer to relieving this frustration is merely to ask more questions and wait for clarification. Nevertheless, based on this particular legal document, we can assume with some certainty that if we apply it to many actions that the Israeli state takes or the American state takes, they are wrong and not respecting our Sharia. They have obviously broken the rule of law, both the Sharia and international legal norms, but are the Muslims to do the same? Certainly the Sharia has been broken by the Israelis, but their difference of opinion is not entertained as a matter of legitimate ikhtilaf. Now, difference of opinion is well recognized as a virtue historically in the Muslim community. This rad, this refutative clarification, is a direct transmission of the modern Shafi'i school. The author himself surfaces from a very strict Shafi'i scholarly tradition in an area where the numbers of scholars, of ulama, easily number in the millions. There's an interesting statistic here. I want you to think about it. The number of Shafi'i ulama, the number of scholars, according to the Shafi'i school, in that particular region, which is the Far East, outnumber the number of Shafi'i awam in the Middle East, i.e. the lay people of the Shafi'i school. I'm not saying this off the cuff. These are actual numbers. And as a direct result, the fatwa that we have under observation is one that is it's very strict, it's very severe as well. But this is the Sharia of Islam, and it is important to note that this law is not Machiavellian in nature, but reflects the lawgiver. This is the adab, the etiquette of the Muslim, and the Muslim is nothing if not a human being of scrupulous etiquette, and herein lies the root of many problems in the Ummah today, a loss of etiquette. It's not victory at all costs, but obeying God and His Messenger at all costs. As one of the sages say, he who makes good his beginning will make good his ending. That tradition that we speak of is both classical and contemporary. It is sound in basis and rooted in the heritage, but as itself demands, there is an insistence on a modern and contemporary expression. Those that disagree with the findings of this are free to do so, but as yet, there have been no fatawa that have been delivered in the same jurisdictional manner as this one. A fatwa must be issued by a mufti through the procedures laid down by his or her school of law. Anything else may be respected as the statement of an honored scholar, but it is not a fatwa. And Aftar brought this up very well, where he talks about the man who has a PhD and goes into a doctor's clinic. Well, let's keep that going for a minute, because the doctor, if he's out in the supermarket or giving a speech, not everything that he says should be considered to be his prescription. His prescription happens after he goes into the surgery. He asks the patient in, or rather the patient goes to him. They discuss his case history, they discuss what applies to him, and so on and so on. And then and only then does he write out a prescription, and then he goes off to the pharmacy. Not everything that he says is designed to be taken as a prescription. And this is precisely the issue that Al-Akiti raises vis-a-vis the document he is clarifying. It was written as a fatwa, but it cannot actually be considered as a fatwa, the document that he is responding to, even if the individual who wrote it had any training. Because in a technical sense, it's not a fatwa. It's a statement, but it's not a fatwa. And there is a difference between the two. It is not so much the content of the document that Al-Akiti particularly disapproves of. That is a side effect. The root of it is the methodology behind it. Now, in the past, we have witnessed how no provocation, not even the deaths of more than 50,000 men, women, and children in a single day, no matter how brutal, was an excuse for people to go against the Sharia. I mentioned that particular number, 50,000, because it was about 50 to maybe 70,000 people, men, women, and children, who were slaughtered in a single day on the streets of Jerusalem. We know from history books that the soldiers who did it, they wrote about it, they were actually quite pleased with themselves. They said that the blood came up to their knees. This was Al-Quds, in the time of Salah ad-Din, or rather just before his time. But even that sort of provocation was no excuse for him when he took back Palestine. We've seen how hundreds of years ago in China, and some of you may have heard this story before, I'm sure you've all heard the story of Salah ad-Din, that there erupted a conflict between the Muslims and the non-Muslims. I don't know how the conflict actually arose, but a conflict happened, there was a battle, and there was a long-running conflict. A war enraged, resulting in many losses on the Muslim side, and it ended in a siege upon a particular fortress. And the fortress lost, essentially. They were done. So they sent out a banner of truce and said to the Muslims, "We have a message for you. Take this to your commander." Took the message to the commander. Commander opens it up and he reads, "You Muslims, when you engage in conflict, give the opposing side three options." This was what the people said. The first is, you give us the offer of Islam, to become Muslim. And then we become a part of you, so the war's over. The second is to accept the jizya, the poll tax, and then we become a part of your state, so the war is over. And the third is to fight. And then we fight. Yet when you fought us, you gave us no such choice. You did not give us these choices, and so you must leave. Now, keep in mind, this is a war that has just come to an end. A lot of people die in wars, and a lot of Muslims died in these wars. And the commander was not very, willing to accept this document simply off the cuff. But he's the commander, he's not the Qadi. So like any good Muslim commander, he says, "Okay, well, this is a legal matter. They're claiming that I have violated the Sharia. So let me take it to the Qadi." So he takes it to the Qadi. The Qadi is a judge of Islamic law, and he asks for his ruling. Now, this is in a time of war, and anyone here can understand why the Qadi would say, "Well, you know what? This is a technicality. These people, they've killed a lot of the Muslims. The war has been quite intense. We've lost a lot of people. They were wrong anyway. So you can just tear up that little document." We can all understand why he would say that, can't we? But he didn't say that. He said, "They're right. You're wrong. You go home." And they packed up and they left. This was after a bloody, brutal conflict. And they left because they knew that the law was above them and was above the national interest of the Muslim and was above the community of the Muslims, because the law is what counts. And they left. No provocation. Not even such losses suffered by the army in such a military conflict, no matter how brutal, was an excuse for them. The adage, all's fair in love and war, simply doesn't apply to the Muslims. Neither the Qadi nor the Mufti, whose fatwa we have just discussed, cared little for the Muslims or for Muslim blood. On the contrary, the latter notes in his fatwa, and I quote, "Yes, we are but one ummah, community, such that when one part of the macro body is attacked somewhere, another part inevitably feels the pain. It is an insult of the highest proportions to suggest that any of us in this room or in the Muslim community outside of those doors does not feel the pain of the children of Palestine or any other part of the Muslim world." It's an insult of the gravest proportions. And God forbid anybody who is a part of this ummah who does not feel that pain. The Prophet ﷺ said, "Whoever shows no mercy will be given no mercy, will be shown no mercy." He also said, "Allah will show no mercy to those who show no mercy to humankind." And he warned his community, being merciful is only stripped away from the damned. The first two ahadith are in Sahih al-Bukhari, and the last one is in the collections of Tirmidhi. And all show very clearly the severity of not showing mercy in general. How much greater this must be when we consider the situation of our brethren living under the yoke of oppression. How much greater the sin must be for the one who does not show mercy to his or her brethren in faith as well as humanity. And if any of us do not feel pain at all, how dead inside is that person? The pain notwithstanding, the real national interest of this ummah is the sunnah of the Prophet ﷺ. It is not the sunnah that serves the national interest. Sometimes indeed it is against it. The Prophet ﷺ always showed adab and decorum, regardless of the strategic position he found himself in, even when the community faced annihilation, and we're not in that situation. So did the Qadi, we mentioned, although he cared for the blood of those who had died. So did numerous ulama and mujahideen in history, and so did the Mufti, we mentioned here today. The second issue that I want to go into briefly is one that leads us into another discussion that is perhaps vaguely linked in so much as it is connected to the idea of a community defined by principle, the issue of integration or assimilation. Yeah, I don't know what these words mean anymore, to be honest with you. Dr. Tahir writes books on it, actually. So. Now, Muslims have long been demographic minorities in non-Muslim territories, but perhaps for the first time in history, they are now viewed as the proverbial fifth column, a proverbial cancer in Western societies. Nevertheless, the sentiment is not only shared amongst Islamophobes like Daniel Pipes in the United States, and we could name lots of people like that. It is shared among some Muslims who feel that they themselves do not belong in the West. In other words, pockets of individuals in the Muslim community help foster this notion of estrangement and difference themselves. This kind of ideology of us against them, as Aftab Malik talked about earlier, is not one that can simply be accepted without challenge. It needs to be discussed. Modern Muslim thought seems less concerned about such spiritual trivialities as the transformation of the soul or the development of a truly human being, and more obsessed with finding a role in the discourse of identity politics. A discourse that I suggest is based on woolly anti-Islamic concepts of pride and arrogant self-interest. In the wake of this bewilderment, many Muslims in the West have been left grappling with who they are and what they are. Not content to satisfy the questioner only on the aspect of denouncing violence and rejecting other negative actions, Sheikh Al-Aqiti takes on this concept of alienation, because it's raised in another question that was asked of him, raised in the allegation that he is responding to, the role and the place of Muslims in the European Union. This is the original document, and it's also part of a question that was asked to him. He notes, and I quote, "They, Muslims, should, as a practical matter, remain in these countries," and he's talking about the European Union, "and if applicable, learn to cure the schizophrenic cultural condition in which they find themselves, whether of torn identity in their souls or of disassociation from the general society. If they cannot do so, and find instead that their surroundings are incompatible with the life they feel they must lead, then it is recommended for them to leave and reside in a Muslim state." End quote. And I assume that he's talking about where they will be more able to fulfill the prophetic imperatives that are due to the neighbor. There is no theoretical waffling or inconsistency in his breakdown of the matter. He's not talking about assimilation. He's not talking about compromises on our principles that define our connections to God and His Prophet, but rather imperatives that flow from our connection to God and His Prophet. And he's not alone in this. Another contemporary scholar, Sheikh Al-Ghanari of Morocco, Allah yarhamu, wrote that it is obligatory for the Muslims in the West to remain in the West. Ibn Taymiyyah, who is a more classical scholar and one who is often abused and misused in people's writings and ideological battles, was very clear about his belief that the Muslims should observe the customs and protocols of the non-Muslim majority. But just as all duties and responsibilities in the Sharia have conditions, so do these positions that Ibn Taymiyyah and Sheikh Al-Ghanari write about. That sense of focusing on imperatives and demands that are truly classical and universal, rather than tribal or neo-nationalistic, is precisely the hallmark of the classical tradition. Irrespective of accusations of terrorism or of cultural ghettoization or any other limited, narrow problem that people want to tar this community unfairly with, the revival of that kind of classical tradition, necessary in the 21st century as in any other century, is not something to be ignored as key to a hopeful future for everyone. For the Muslims in particular, victory is only assured when honest self-appraisal is done. For truly, the state of ourselves is not changed without such self-appraisal, and truly God does not change the state of a people until they first change themselves. This is a message I am content to end on with the reminder of the responsibility upon me and upon us all. Thank you very much.
Jazakallah, and very glad that your voice held out throughout that.